Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime and Corrections to come to order. Our agenda today includes Senate Bill 591, Senate Bill 703, Senate Bill 131, the informational hearing on 1073. Why don't we start out? Is anyone here on 703, the Police Officer's Bill of Rights?
I'm a state police, but I'm just here to monitor. I wasn't
okay.
Prepared to give a testimony.
Kim, why don't you leave that open? We're going to need to go in and out probably very quickly. Real quickly. Go ahead, Representative Bowen. You got any more members coming in?
Peter's probably on the way. 591 should have materials.
Okay, five. Do you have the amendments in 591? You have a seat,
well,
Representative Barr.
Okay, that's it.
Yes. Oh, that's
right. Let me
take my packet.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Is it in order for me to make a motion?
Certainly. We're on 591. This was our little torpedo bill. Peter, we're on 591. Kevin has some amendments to clear off 591. Let's see if we can get this thing cranked up and get it out of here soon. Kevin, Representative Mannix.
Thank you. On 591, you will have on my stationery amendments to 591, the three sections 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. What that amendment does is it takes the Association of Oregon Counties proposals but modifies them. They had some modified amendments that they presented during an earlier hearing. It uses all of that, but it also addresses the objection certain members of this committee made, which is we don't want to be doing all the technical detail work about jail overcrowding. Let's simply give the county commissioners authority to develop a plan for their county and to implement that plan if they have overcrowding in the jail. That's what these amendments do. They don't say anything about when you reach 95% or whether there's a 24-hour requirement or 48-hour requirement. All of that has been stripped out to simply allow the county officials the authority to develop, to make the decision whether to develop a plan as to jail overcrowding. If they decide to develop a plan, they also have the authority to implement it, and it gives the sheriff the basic authority to carry out the reduction of population under any local plan. But it's up to the county to decide that they want to do it in the first place.
Let's be very frank. On 591, the chair would move Representative Mannix's amendments. This bill either goes now or is dead. So why don't we, Representative Mannix, anything further before we vote in the adoption of your amendments?
I think the amendments address concerns that several representatives have presented to me about laying out a plan for the counties instead of letting the counties make their own plan.
Okay. Representative Miller.
Representative Mannix, would it be your impression that this continues to be an option for counties?
That is, in fact, sections 1 and 2 stay undisturbed in the bill, and it would be an option. They can decide not to do a thing.
Thank you.
Okay. No further. Is there any objection to the Mannix amendments? Hearing none, so ordered. Clerk, call the roll on 591.
Representative McDonald?
Yes.
Bowman?
Aye.
Bryant?
Aye.
Lowry?
Aye.
Courtney?
Yes.
Mannix?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Chair Mason? Aye. Now that, of course, is on the chair's motion to send it before due pass as amended. Let's move on to Senate Bill 131. Is Mr. Leak here? Okay, on Senate Bill 131, we have had a strong request from the Mothers Against Drunken Driving to integrate into 131 certain amendments. They would be the 131-9 amendments. I'm going to pass some around. Basically, this would be putting into 131, what was the bill?
130.
Yes, putting 130 into 131. Do you remember Senate Bill 130? Field sobriety. These amendments, if I remember field sobriety? These amendments basically require BPST to develop by administrative rules standard field sobriety tests. Now, last time this bill was before us, our major concern was on the lack of regularity of standard field sobriety tests. That was my big objection. We had a real nice heart-to-heart, the DUI people and the MAD people and I last Friday. It's lots of fun. and decided as a possible compromise to have BPST develop standardized, uniform field sobriety tests. I don't know whether or not that will raise certain comfort levels to the necessary level or not. Be that as it may. Now, what's your reaction to that? As they walk out. No. Representative Mannix.
My reaction, Mr. Chairman, if you're asking whether it's the committee or the public's reaction, I support that when we can come up with that kind of language.
Okay.
I think that deals with the problem.
Those are in the amendments. So why don't we start the bidding on 131 by adopting the amendments entitled 131-A9, which basically require the imposition of or require the creation of standardized field sobriety tests, and also implement the rest of 130, which allows comment on the failure to take. No, not today. The failure to do field sobriety tests. Representative Bryan. So moved. Any objection to the adoption of 131-A9? Hearing none, so ordered. Now, is Mr. Leek here yet?
I just called him.
Okay.
Probably Leakey upstairs.
Okay. I know, we haven't voted yet, have we? Okay. I want to give him...
Witty, he's uncontrolled.
I want to give Mr. Leek one shot at us before we gut the rest out of this bill.
If you're near judiciary now, let's...
Come on, we're not going to get out of here unless you sit down.
I voted right.
Okay, Mr. Kaiser, come in here because we're going to do 7:03 in about 2 minutes. Have a seat. Where is this? My subcommittee? Too late. I'm giving this over to higher authority to make a decision. We're Mr. Kaiser, we're not quite on your bill yet, but you can sit there anyway.
Well, let me know if you'd like me to move, I'll be...
That's okay. On 131, what's the committee's pleasure? You want to try to put this interlock thing in it right now? You want to gut it, or you want to send it out, and do it in conference committee? Representative Bryan?
Sure, I think the testimony convinced me it's going to be fine.
Okay. So why don't we, Representative Bryan's motion is to delete all the interlock language, send it to the floor just as the field sobriety test bill.
The very extended existing program. That's how it started. I think the original 131 extended the existing program.
Okay.
Let him put it back in
office. Yes. Extend the existing program. You want to do that? Representative Flores.
And it was Leek's proposal that affected the evaluators. Yeah,
they were playing with the evaluators.
Yeah. No, Mr. Chair, committee members, I believe the dash 6, 7, and 8 options do not affect evaluators. Those are new options.
Okay, what are they? Are you going to tell us what those are?
I have barely reviewed them.
Representative Bauman?
Yeah, I'd like to include Section 4. This was an interlock pilot program, sunset on June 30th, 1989. And the Angra Senate Bill 131 continues it through June 30th, 1993.
Do you want to keep Section 4 in?
Mr. Chair,
Suker.
I think the problem with just continuing the program and not having it sunset was that given the current status of the program, the company that manufactured the devices was going to leave. So the practical effect of continuing the sunset or getting rid of the sunset wouldn't help the situation any. I think Mr. Leek has to speak to this if you could wait until he appears.
Okay. Okay. Let's put 131 aside for a moment. Mr. Kaiser, back to 703. Mr. Kaiser, tell us why we need this bill again. 703. Police Officer Bill of Rights.
For the record, my name is Bob Kaiser. I represent the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Senate Bill 703 is an attempt to standardize some of the rights that police officers have throughout the state. Currently, all police officers attend training at the Police Academy in Monmouth. Their training is standardized. Their ongoing training is, you know, they all participate in the same kind of training classes and exercises. And so this is just an attempt to standardize and give some uniformity to the rights that police officers have throughout the state. As I mentioned in my testimony, there's approximately 180 different law enforcement units in the state. There's only 9, to our knowledge, that have a police officer's Bill of Rights in their collective bargaining agreement.
Representative Flory.
Are these negotiable? Labor negotiable?
As far as I know, once they're in the statute, they're not negotiable.
No, but could they be negotiated rather than doing it this way?
Representative Clory, Mr. Chair, they can be negotiated through collective bargaining. Many police organizations, law enforcement units, do not participate in collective bargaining.
Anything further, Mr. Kaiser? Mr. Kaiser.
There's one change that needs to be made because the language is incorrect, and that's okay. In Section 1, Subsection 1, the definition of disciplinary action. It needs to be changed. It currently says disciplinary action means any action taken against an employing law enforcement unit. That's totally incorrect. It needs to be changed. I've got some language that I could offer.
Okay, offer it.
It's a definition of disciplinary action that is in ORS 236.350. Disciplinary action means any action taken against a police officer by a public employer for the purposes of punishing the officer, including dismissal, demotion, suspension without pay, reduction in salary, written reprimand, or transfer.
Any objection to the chair's moving of that definitional change? On the bill.
Winner or call?
On the bill.
I'm happy to hear that the Police Officers Association is so strongly supportive of the Bill of Rights.
Any motions on the bill?
I move it.
To the floor, do pass as amended. Representative Courtney, who makes the motion? The clerk, call the roll.
Baum?
Yes.
Baum?
No,
aye. Ryan?
No.
Aye.
Flory?
No.
Courtney?
Yes.
Manny?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Chair Bison?
Aye. Brenner, call. We'll be back as soon as we're off the call, and we'll handle 131. Mr. Leek, please don't leave. Okay. Let's go on the floor to vote. Be back right after the call. Temporarily recess.
I got my
Okay, we got 591
on. No, they're not giving me a chance. Yeah, real well done.
Hey, it was wonderful.
back in session here. As soon as Vi breaks the door, we'll start the testimony. Mr. Leek, tell us what version. We just amended Senate Bill 131 to include a field sobriety test, added that onto the bill. What's your preference for your amendments on interlock, and tell us why?
Mr. Chairman, Ed Leek, Legislative Assistant Senator Springer, tried, Mr. Chairman, to give the committee a Lazy Susan group of options here as to how they want to handle. Let me just tell you briefly what the three amendments do very, very quickly.
Name them.
Okay, Amendment 6 says everybody...
6, 7, and 8, that's what we're working
with? 6, 7, and 8. 6,
okay,
7, and
6, 8. 6, 7, and 8.
Number 6 says everybody that's convicted gets the interlock at the end of the period of suspension for 6 months. Anybody who is indigent gets that paid for out of the intoxicated driver fund, doesn't build the fund at all.
So what does that do to your counselors? What does that do to the counselors?
No effect, Mr. Chairman. None of these amendments that you have before you have any effect on either diversion or the evaluators.
And how's A6 paid for?
A6 is paid for out of the intoxicated driver fund.
Which has, in
each of the six preceding biennials, had a balance of $1.5 million.
Give us a view of A7, though.
A7, Mr. Chairman, does the same thing, except it increases the assessment for the intoxicated driver fund by $20. And so if you're concerned about the balance in the fund, which may or may not be a real concern, you would adopt the A7 amendments. This is pays for the cost of administration and the indigents out of 7.
And
A8 does the same thing but adds the no-blows, the administrative suspensions for people who have declined to blow into the breathalyzer. There is one other possibility, Mr. Chairman, and it's just trying to make it simple, Mr. Chairman, if I can, and that is just as you do as the DMV now was when you come back and file an SR-22 at the end of when you want to get your license back, what you do is they don't have any indigents. And since we're making this administrative, we can forget about paying for the indigents. If you want to do that, we can do that. If you wanted to take that option, Mr. Chairman, you would take number 6 and remove the references to the indigents.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, we don't have a preference in regard to any of these. The program, if it's merely an extension of the current program, will die because the vendor will leave.
Okay, we took care of that part in the bill. What's your preference? Representative Brian, do you have a preference on this?
Well, I'm still, the testimony I heard before seemed to argue against this direction. I missed part of the presentation about all of the other options.
Go ahead, let's have Representative Brian.
Intention was to extend the existing program.
Representative Mannix.
As I understand it, we're not doing anything to take away from the current alternatives that are available under these three amendments. That's the part that we missed before you came in the room.
Yeah.
I think that's important.
Yes.
Mr. Leek was talking about that.
It's a question of finance under these amendments mainly. I like the $20 A7s personally, but
I have one question on what
Mannix.
You were talking about the no blow. What is the language in A8 that addresses that?
The A8 language, I think. I might have to get the.
Is that.
Okay, which section is that?
Page 3, perhaps, at the bottom. Runs on.
A13 is the 410 language, which is in. Oh, it's on the very first page. Okay, where I missed it. Ah, yes, on line 22. On the A8, on the A8. It's after the ending date of suspension under ORS 813-410. That's where you refuse to take the breathalyzer.
Representative Mannix.
I move the A7 version.
Representative Mannix moves the A7 version, especially the $20 plan. Any discussion? Sucker? A7 was what you moved. Sucker, anything? Representative Ryan, is A7 okay?
I have no idea what it is.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, one more time. What it does is it requires that on all convictees and pays for the indigents and cost of administration by increasing the assessment by $20. on those convicted.
Is this,
Chairman? Go
ahead. Do away with all the testimony we had, all the problems about raiding of other funds?
Yes.
Yes, it does.
That's the whole purpose.
Wait a second. Well, maybe Mr. Campbell should come up here and comment to the committee because Mr. Campbell here had his shake. No.
Mr. Campbell. Identify yourself for the record, Mr. Campbell, and state your objection, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bauman.
I don't know about it. I don't care about concerns. I want objections.
You can't hear with this door open. The noise is blasting. Come on, close it, please. Then I'll reopen.
Go ahead. Hard.
Thank you. We have had a chance to look at the various amendments, and I take it your
A7.
A7 is the one you're preferring at this moment. I'm trying to find my notes on that one.
Working with Senate Bill 131, the amendments 131-A7.
Oh, yeah, I'm trying to find my analysis of it.
Well, if I could help, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bauman.
The moment where I caught the body language from Mr. Campbell was at the point when Mr. Leek said that all of the objections that had been raised to the evaluator program were answered in the dash A7s. So maybe Mr. Campbell, you can just articulate what that body language.
The evaluators were concerned, frankly, for simply their own jobs.
Under A7?
No, under A3.
We're talking about A7, Mr. Campbell.
I know, but I'm responding to Representative Baum.
No, Representative Baum wanted to know about A7. Didn't you, Representative Baum?
Yeah, I was just interested because the object of the A7 is to address the concerns that the evaluators had and the program had.
Yes, the A7 does leave in place the evaluation and monitoring system that was the number one concern expressed by those on the A3. It does not adequately deal with the other concern, which is the drain on the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund.
Even at $20?
Even at $20.
What would you suggest?
I would specifically suggest two things. One, move it to $25, and the second is to get rid of the study that Traffic Safety is directed to do of the diversion program.
Where is that found in the amendment? Mr. Leek, is the study essential to this bill?
Mr. Chairman, the issue here, I think, is that's found on page 4, lines 13 through 21. Mr. Chairman, it's not essential, but I believe that this committee will find itself at the next session in exactly the same situation it finds itself right now in regards to the efficacy of diversion altogether. It's a $10 to $12 million industry on an annual basis in this state with, if one believes the national studies, a little to no effect. And we believe it's important for that.
Gentlemen, I'd rather delete it than get in a debate here today. I'm trying to craft a compromise here. Actually, looks like I'm trying to jam things down people's throats. But
we have already communicated with Traffic Safety Commission about a month ago, and they have agreed to fund such a study with federal traffic safety money. There's no need to drain the fund. If you don't do that and you go to 25, it'll break even and we'll shut up.
Slick, can you swallow this at 25 without the study?
Mr. Chairman, if this study is funded by the feds, that would be fine, and there's no statement in here about who pays for the study. The Traffic Safety Commission over the last biennium has taken very, very few dollars from the Intoxicated Drivers Funds and plans to act in exactly the same manner. So,
do we need the study in the bill?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we do.
Mr. Campbell.
If you look at the back of the bill, one of the things it does is to amend 813-270 so that the fund specifically is made available to pay for the cost of the study.
Mr. Miller, Representative Miller.
I had one question for Mr. Lee. You mentioned the feds. Is that feds would pay for this.
Mr. Campbell brought that up.
Traffic Safety Commission has agreed to set aside $75,000. Which is more than enough to do the study.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back. We've got to vote.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, there is no guarantee of the federal money to do that.
The floor being allowed to vote, if you want to go in and vote on this.
Okay, we're back in. Mr. Leek, what do we got? What do you got for us?
Mr. Chairman, I've talked with Traffic Safety. They have they are making an application for federal funds. They believe they may get them, but they're not sure that they're going to get them. There's no guarantee that we can offer at this point they are going to get it. They have, as I said, in the last buy-in and been very careful and have not taken any administrative money from the fund.
Mr. Leek, I've got to move this. I'm going to move that we delete the study portion found on page 4, lines 13 through 21, appropriate adjustments to the deletion of the study portion, up to $20 to $25.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, what I would rather you do, Mr. Chairman, is to delete on lines on page 6, number 22 and number 23. I'm sorry, I'm looking at the dash 6 amendments I gave Representative Bryan. It's the payment that it's on the page 9, lines 14 and 15. That way, Mr. Chairman, the fund.
Okay.
If the feds pay for it, they'll do it. If the feds don't pay for it, they won't do it.
Okay. So moved. Any objection to those amendments? Of the amendments. Representative Miller. The chair had moved the 131-A7 amendments. Any objection?
I'd already moved.
Okay. Any objection to adoption? Representative Mannix moves 131 to the floor. Do pass. Full committee, do pass as amended.
Is it unreasonable to have you kind of summarize what it is that we are now voting on?
Right now it is. Clerk, call roll, please.
No. Aye.
No.
Aye. This is subcommittee. Wait. Why don't we? We're going to return for a moment to Senate Bill 703. Before I reconsider 703. Okay. I have a. Mr. Kaiser, and I also have some city people up here on 703. Mr. Marquis, Mr. Kaiser, and where's our city person?
Haas.
What?
Haas.
Connie Haas. Ms. Haas, Mr. Kaiser is just here to respond. Mr. Marquis has some of his own amendments. Ms. Haas, very quickly, before we reconsider this bill, I'm not going to let it come back until we get resolution. So. Tell us quickly what you want and what you've agreed to.
Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, I'm Jim Marquis representing Amalgamated Transit Union, and I apologize for not getting here earlier. These amendments didn't get typed in time. We've had a lot of problems on buses, as you know.
I'll be back. For the record, ma'am.
For the record, Colleen Haas, Local Government Personnel Institute, representing cities and counties. We've worked with the proponents of the bill to come up with a compromise on the bill. In front of you on LGPI letterhead is that compromise. There is only one portion of that two-page compromise that we have not agreed on, and that's Section 8 of the second page. It has to do with whether or not a locker is...
Ma'am, if I was you, I'd take it out, because if it doesn't come out, this bill isn't coming back up.
We'll take it out if we can have the rest of it.
No, just take it out. You see, this bill has already passed. See, so I hate to be so brutal, but this bill has passed.
What you're saying is none of the other compromise changes that we've agreed to with...
I'm saying 8 is out, but everything else is in.
All right.
You don't understand? I'm just saying that you hadn't compromised on Section 8.
That's That's true.
Okay. Well, then eight, the locker thing is still in.
All right.
Okay.
The rest of the compromise is agreeable to the committee.
Are you, Mr. Kaiser, you all right with the rest of the compromise on the LP?
Yes.
All GPI letterhead? Okay. Now, Mr. Marquis, yes. You have an amendment for us on the attacking of...
Yes.
Attacking of police, of transit officers, attacking the bus drivers.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Jim Markey for Amalgamated Transit Union. The effect of my amendment is simply to...
Sorry.
Might provide for a prison term, that you can anticipate that there may be some manipulation of charging practices or sentencing practices. And that has a significant impact on two things. It has a significant impact on the criminal histories of those people who are sentenced as misdemeanants instead of as felons, so that you get an increasing inaccuracy in those records. It also has an impact on local jails. And the counties are concerned about that, and the sheriffs are concerned about that. What the Senate did was to put into law a temporary cap on misdemeanor sentences so that no misdemeanor could be sentenced to a jail term of longer than 6 months.
A jail term, of longer than six months.
Existing law says misdemeanors can be sentenced up to a year. We have a considerable database on felony sentencing practices. We don't have a database on misdemeanor sentencing practices, but the judges here, and I think current wisdom is that very few misdemeanants are ever getting anywhere near a year in local jails now. This cap has exclusions for DUII. They could be sentenced up to a year if the county has jail space available. And there's an exception for sex offenses or attempted Class C felony sex offenses, so that those offenses could also be sentenced.
Let me stop you. That sounds very sexy, the fact that you've excluded DUII, but why would you hold assaults and other misdemeanors to 6 months and DUI to a year? Is there some logic to that?
Frankly, I think the logic, I'm Judge Ellis, Mr. Chairman, was primarily that is such an emotional issue, and it's a change that does not make an actual change from present practice, in that most counties in Oregon, covering most of the population of the state, are not in a position to confine any misdemeanor for any substantial part of 365 days in any event. What we were trying to do is to simply avoid the warping of the system by permitting prosecutors to elect to prosecute people as a misdemeanor instead of a felony. let me ask and avoid you, the process.
Let me ask you this, Judge, before I turn you over to Representative Clark. Notwithstanding my objection to treating DUI different, would it make any substantial difference in the bill just to leave well enough alone? I mean, I can see, I would like to pull out this DUI nonsense.
Because the symmetry, exception?
Symmetry, but am I just causing trouble?
Well, we were primarily concerned that in a vast number of crimes, there is a lesser included misdemeanor. Driving under the influence really does not come out a lesser included misdemeanor of any Class C felony that anybody could think of.
Representative Clark.
Judge, I got to make sure I understand the problem. You get charged with a felony. The prosecutor or the judge looks at, I suppose the prosecutor looks at the guidelines of how you would be charged, how you would be sentenced if you were convicted of this felony, sees that you would maybe get, let's say, 10 months under the guidelines, given your criminal history and all like that, and says, hey, wait a minute, if I drop this to a misdemeanor, charging something else, I can give them a year in this county slammer. And that's the problem you're trying to get around.
Yeah, it just warps the whole system. It'll make the statistics difficult to compare. An example would be, we get a lot of shoplifters now who are charged with a felony because they grab clothing and it turns out it's worth more than the statutory amount, the difference between theft one and theft two.
But there's that nonsense, they're now they push the clerk to.
You make a robbery out of it if they hold
Rios the robbery, is that what it's called? Yeah, I remember one of those. Wonderful case.
Motion for adjournment.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up.
Okay.
We're talking about 1073 says that notwithstanding other provisions of Oregon law, you can only get a maximum of 6 months jail time for misdemeanors. And the reason they're trying to do that is to get around the scenario where you get charged with a felony, the guidelines will give you 10 months, the judge says, hey, I can give you a year in your local jail. And I'm a little bit uncomfortable, I see the reason for doing that, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with it. On the other hand, if you don't do that, I think you're telling me you're going to fill up your local jails.
That's
like
the concern. The counties are very concerned about this, that all of a sudden they could be,
transferring
a big population to the counties that now are the responsibility of the State Department of Corrections.
Judge Ellis, you have never done this, but some of your brothers and sisters have been known to do this quite a bit, if I remember right.
Well, and there's a general tendency. I think probably many of us on property offenses are giving misdemeanor or giving county jail sentences as a condition of probation before sending people to penitentiary. That could probably be justified. Simply to confine people longer, it's an effective way, the judge thinks, to protect the public, but it's a kind of a warping of the system where you have. And one of the things we thought we might be walking into a constitutional problem, there's an Oregon appellate decision from some years ago that held that where through inadvertence in drafting, we had a statutory penalty more severe for an attempt than for a completed crime. And the response of the appellate courts was that that's an unconstitutional.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baum just raised a good point, which is I assume that this provision is only a 2-year provision if we get misdemeanor guidelines coming on board.
That was the idea.
Then there will be
then a rational system that would cover the entire gamut of the criminal justice system.
It
would
does.
Cover.
It
935.
It does.
Okay.
It repeals that section as of November 1, 1991.
Yes, exactly. Okay.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go on, please.
Section 87, I think, will be of interest to you. It's language added by the Senate committee that is an affirmative vote on the guidelines rules, now included in 1073, so that the guidelines rules are in place. The guidelines, as a process, would not work if 1073 didn't pass, because 1073 provides that the judges will use them in the statutory framework of the sentencing statutes under Chapter 137. It provides an appellate process. You need 1073 to make the guidelines work. Now, with the passage of 1073, there is also added this language,
65th Legislative Assembly affirms
the
sentencing guidelines as developed by the State Sentencing Guidelines Board in Chapter 619, Oregon Laws 1987, page 36, lines 12 and 13.
Okay, that's one of the.
So this is the language for the vote on the guidelines that you all had said when we were before you, before you felt was important to have.
And Mr. Chair, just for the record, you know, one of the amendments that I will be proposing expands this a bit. The ongoing work of the Sentencing Guidelines Board being brought back to the legislature in the future for amendments and all those things.
Zuckerman, you look perplexed. Do you lose you? I don't think that Representative Clark's amendments are free yet.
I want to let them get through the bill.
Okay.
Most of my amendments, Mr. Chair, don't amend Senate Bill 1073. They amend the guidelines.
Okay.
The rules.
So why don't we return? Now, what would you, what was your pleasure now?
Just a time. Now, I'm trying to get
you want to go through the bill section by section?
I want to go through it sort of issue by issue.
These
I see six or seven issues.
So why don't you lead us through them?
Okay.
Sure.
I'm done with the
camera. That's fine. No, that's fine. Appellate review standards. Substantial and compelling. We got some of that first time around. I understand that Judge Joseph is animated about this topic.
It's a nice term.
I don't know whether he's going to talk to us or not. Somebody can lay Judge Joseph for a minute and tell us what his argument is.
Only Representative Courtney on a really good day.
Well, I'll try to explain to you what I think the two sides of the issue are. I would not attempt to play Judge Joseph, but the enabling legislation in 87 said to the council and the board that they should allow for departures from the sentencing guidelines for substantial and compelling reasons. That language was put into the 87 Act. It was put into the 87 Act because that is the language that is used in Minnesota and in Washington in their legislation, saying that they can depart, judges there can depart if they find substantial and compelling reasons. When we adopted the rules, there was considerable debate on the board about that language and what that language meant and whether it made any sense. Judge Joseph's feeling was that the word compelling had no legal meaning standing on its own. I don't think that the linguistics of substantial and compelling are as important as what it is that the legislature wants the court to use, what it wants it to do in making a departure, and what level of review it wants the appellate court to provide. And there was a very clear record made on the Senate side that departures should only be made in extraordinary cases, that they are to be uncommon cases. Not more than 10% of the cases is the rough idea that we worked with. So there should be some significant reasons, substantial and compelling reasons for the trial court to impose a sentence other than a presumptive one. The substantial and compelling standard is also the one that the Court of Appeals is to use. It's to look at the record to see if the judge in the trial court found substantial and compelling reasons. And the language that was put on the record in both the Senate committee and in Senator Springer's floor speech when he carried that portion of the bill is that this is to be the test. The appellate court is to look at what the trial court did and is to do two things. It's first of all to see if the facts that the court relied upon for departing, the victim was exceptionally vulnerable because was 4 years old, 5 years old, or was a person who was disabled, are those facts in the record? That's not a burdensome test. The appellate court is not to substitute its judgment for that of the trial court as to that. It's simply to look and see, were the facts in the record? If not, that's a clearly erroneous decision. So it's basically a factual inquiry that the appellate court is to make. The second part of the inquiry is the reasons that the judge gave for departing. I'm going to aggravate this sentence because the victim was especially vulnerable, or because you have a long history of persistent involvement in this kind of offense. Beyond the facts is the reason that the trial court gave either one of the reasons given in the rules as an aggravating or mitigating reason, or is it consistent with those reasons and consistent with the purposes of the act? Now, there are bound to be other reasons than the board thought of in drawing up the rules. Why a court would ultimately aggravate or mitigate a sentence. The inquiry at the appellate court level is just to be, is that consistent with the purposes of the act for punishment, public safety, reasons. So the record over there is what that body wanted the court to look at when it was reviewing the decision of the trial court. Substantial and compelling is the language used in two other states that makes that case law accessible to our appellate court. In interpreting what substantial and compelling means. Judge Joseph's concerns were twofold. Was there going to be de novo review of the trial court? And I think the record's real clear over there that nobody intends it to be de novo review. That's basically another look at the facts and substituting your judgment at the appellate court level for the trial court's facts. The second one, is there supposed to be a comparative sentence review? Is there if I get a decision from a trial court, the guy's given 16 months as a burglar, does he look uglier than the guy who got 14 months from Deschutes County for a burglary and less ugly than the guy who got 20 months from Multnomah County for a burglary? Judge Joseph was extremely concerned about the court's ability to do that and the workload that that would impose on the court. And I think the record's also clear over there that that's not the intention of the review standard. It is not meant that they have to compare every trial court sentence and fit them all, get the 21-month one in between the 22 and the 20-month one.
So I understand you're saying a couple of things. You got to find substantial and compelling, whatever that means. And that means, I think Judge Ellis put it this way in one of our earlier hearings, a darn good reason.
I was actually quoting Peter Ozan.
Peter Ozan,
what he said was,
right.
It is a damn good reason.
Damn good reason. I remember that. It sounded like something. All right, so you got to have a damn good reason. It's got to be in the record. And it's got the reason has to somehow be tied in to the guidelines for policy's purposes. And I understand that. You can't do it because you got red hair and somebody else has brown hair. Where are those reasons, though? What reasons are in the guidelines that we're talking about? What's fair game? Where do I go in the rules or in 1073 or someplace else? Where do I go to find those reasons?
The departure standards, I think, are in the rules at Section K.
Okay, but that's what we're talking about. That's where you go.
But it's a non-exclusive list.
I
wanted to find some of the other rules and policies of the guidelines that are the other than as specifically excluded in that section. Where would I go? Purposes and principles? Right up front?
Purposes and principles?
Yes. Where else?
Case law out of the two other states at least.
I'm trying to make legislative history here. I'm trying to see where would I go if I didn't want to be limited to the rules set out there? Because it does say including but not limited to. So we're saying purposes and principles statement, have the case law, any place else that I might go for further guidance as to what's it doing.
Might find something in existing law, but I'm not sure there's any case authority on it.
I think existing law as to aggravating and mitigating, again, if those reasons given were consistent with the purposes of the guidelines.
I would think, it seems to me, as I sit here and listen to these, first of all, you talked about the facts. You gave the example of, is the victim particularly vulnerable? That would be an aggravating fact. Are there actual facts to support your determination? Secondly, is that determination consistent with the purposes of the act, which is punishment and public safety? It seems to me, and Judge Ellis, you might want to comment on this, that as I run through these scenarios in my mind, you know, it would probably be easier to prove mitigation than aggravation.
Well, we've had probably more experience the other way. Because we have a present requirement that judges, Yes, because we have the present requirement in Oregon that judges, at least in felony sentence, must state the reasons for their sentencing. And I think the emphasis has been to, in effect, justify the punitive aspect of the sentence.
Yeah.
I know you won't get any appeals, for one thing, if you enter a sentence of discharge, because under present law you don't let the state appeal. So
but under this,
under this, they
couldn't.
Under this, they can.
That's
judges will have to articulate the reasons for not following the presumptive sentence. But I think you get them in about equal share.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to focus on the horrible examples because that's what everyone's concerned about in terms of public safety. One occurred to me while we were sitting here. I had a rape case years ago. Two or three young men abducted a young woman, a girl who was delivering newspapers from a car in the early morning, and raped her, or one of them did, with the others participating. The young man I had was convicted, and I don't recall now whether it was an accomplice or the actual perpetrator, but he came back to the scene, got the girl, took her from the scene where it occurred. The others left. He came back, took her back to where they'd abducted her, and they dumped her papers out of the car, gathered the papers up, helped her deliver them, and then took her to Emmanuel Hospital and waited for her. And we weren't even required to state reasons then, but I ended up putting her on probation. The victim approved of it. And that's an example of a mitigation, a departure down, in effect, because that would be a presumptive sentence of prison today under the guidelines.
Just here one follow-up question on departure charges. In front of the board, or the council, I guess, somebody made a motion at your last meeting, and I remember that the council was divided on it as to whether to go with just substantial or whether it would be substantial and compelling. Is that accurate? Somebody made that motion. There's a division on the council on this as well.
That's true.
And given the kind of legislative history that you tell me has been made in the Senate and that we're trying to make here, in terms of saying you've got to have a little bit of reason apart from the guidelines, what's behind, if you can summarize for me, what's behind the motion? I mean, somebody thought that substantial meant different than substantial and compelling, and I'm trying to get a sense for what's the difference. What was the debate by the council on that? I mean, what is the difference between substantial and substantial compelling?
The debate, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the day that you attended the board meeting, the May board meeting, was the day that the board subsequently voted to use substantial and compelling as the standard. And the debate that day was along the lines that I think we've just recreated here, that there need to be damn good reasons. Peter Ozan was at the board meeting that day for departing. Previously, the board had settled on a substantial standard last December, persuaded by the argument that compelling added nothing to substantial.
But now we're back with compelling? Well, one thing I might point out for Representative Courtney and Representative Clark, you guys just had a love affair with substantial here a few days ago.
There's a difference between substantial evidence and substantial reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay.
Point made by the Attorney General.
On 2713, I thought.
If
2713, wasn't that substantial?
If I could suggest.
I remember going up there and listening to you guys go round and round and round about substantial. So this is a totally different bill, but
that was administrative law, wasn't it?
That has been some of the concern. And this is not. This does not deal with substantial evidence. This is reason, substantial and compelling reasons. And frankly, I had the same question. I can't visualize a reason that's substantial but not compelling, or one that's compelling but not substantial. I couldn't think of an example of one of those. To me, the reason for sticking with substantial and compelling is if we mean essentially what the other states have meant.
Well, it seems to me, too, it does seem to me that substantial and compelling is a higher standard than substantial, and that's with no particular expertise in the area, just listening to the terms and understanding where they're used elsewhere in the law.
The sort of thing you could not do, I think we're all agreed, is you could say that certainly there's a substantial difference between a man and a woman, or a small man and a large man. But just on the face of that, that's not probably, although it may be a substantial reason, it's not a compelling reason for imposing different sentences.
Well, maybe that's the very phrase compelling. It means, Judge, there's phrases elsewhere in the law about something unconscionable, turns the stomach of the court and all that. I can see a judge saying, I am compelled by the fact in front of me, as I just now recited. I can't do anything but depart from the standards here. I am compelled to do this. There's no way around being good conscience and all that.
Which one do you like?
Can I interrupt for a moment?
Well, Representative Mannix.
While you're thinking about that.
Representative Mannix.
Okay, this is on another subject.
Okay.
But I want to make it clear. We did pass a bill out that makes it clear that victims are allowed to have access to pre-sentence reports.
Yes.
And the fact is that's going to be in legislation, because I noticed we're just reduplicating the other provisions here that don't have that change in it. Okay, thank you.
Representative Clark, what's your feeling on this?
I understand what we're talking about, substantial compelling. I'm curious as to whether the committee
was the best.
Well, I personally think that the content has been the content of the words have been supplied by the discussion, and by the as outlined in Spilgen when she talked about what about whether or not there were facts, whether or not it was consistent with the. with the purpose of the act, I find that relatively objective. And for my purposes, for the purposes of the act, I like the term simple, the simpler term, substantial. And I don't, so I can live with either one of them, to be very frank. I do think, though, that the term compelling might someplace, sometime, somewhere be a avenue of mischief for someone on either side, but I'm not in love with the language. Maybe you can highlight that. Representative Bauman, you're shifting.
Yes. Well, I thought that the explanation that we just had on the difference between or potential interpretations of the word substantial contrasted with compelling is helpful. Substantial
might be just
quantitative compelling. It's a very qualitative judgment.
Well, can we move on to the next topic? Do you have one? You want to lead us, or
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Mannix?
My observation is I've heard lots of substantial arguments, even in this committee, from time to time, that I didn't find compelling in the sense that I wasn't convinced. Although I recognize the merit of the proposition. So I guess in that sense, I think Representative Bauman's point about quantity and then quality are important.
I suspect, though, that when judges are making these decisions, like so much of the time, some of you noticed with judges, they make their decisions and they hook them into the language. Like when I was prosecuting, whenever I heard a judge say, beyond a reasonable doubt, that usually meant I had blown it. You've proven your case, but not beyond a reasonable doubt. That was kind of, the words just kind of slid in there at the end. Representative Baum.
What are the Supreme Court judges? How are they going to do that section that talks about whether this meter shall not exceed 6 months when the second judge might be against the one reason? What are the circuit judges
going to take about the sentencing standards? Mr. Chairman, Representative Baum, I think actually the impact will not be primarily on the circuit judges. The impact's going to be primarily on the district judges, municipal judges, and justices of the peace, because they handle the bulk of the misdemeanors.
Whoever.
And I would think, I was discussing this with someone today, on the attitudes toward guidelines, all of us are made uncomfortable by change. Those who are opposed to change will not like it because it's a change. In the relatively rare counties where they have enough jail space that people can not only be sentenced to a year in jail for a misdemeanor but then be required to serve it, that will limit the power of the court under that. But I think in most counties, it's academic. I mean, Multnomah County, we can't keep people in jail a week for a misdemeanor, so whether we can sentence them to 6 months or a year is a matter of indifference. As I understand, there are several other counties that they simply do not sentence misdemeanors to jail at all. There are no jail sentences. There are counties, I'm told, where five-time drunk drivers get no days in jail because they have no space for misdemeanors. So I think it'll depend a lot upon what county the judge is in. But I would think there'd be a lack of enthusiasm about it. Body of material in connection with guidelines has been sent out to judges. Whether this particular provision was or not, I'm not certain. I know some judges are aware of it.
When was this put in? It's always in here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baum, that specific language was the result of a conference meeting. The DAs, the defense bar, the court administrator, Judge Ellis, you were there.
Yes.
There was no district court judge there. Before the Senate voted the bill out, so it was a couple of weeks ago. So this specific language, the district court judges probably have not seen.
Representative Mann.
Back to this substantial and compelling language on page 11 of the B. Engross bill. I noticed that in line 23, we talk about review shall be limited to whether the sentencing court's findings of fact justifying a departure from the sentence prescribed by the rule, are supported by the evidence and constitutional substantial and compelling reasons. We don't refer to reasons, we refer only to findings of fact. And I wonder how you feel about us inserting the words and reasons. So say on 23, line 23, page 11, be limited to whether the sentencing court's findings of fact and reasons justifying a departure. A technical point, but You're only talking about findings of fact. Findings of fact themselves do not constitute substantial and compelling reasons for departure. There's got to be some logic presented, some reasoning process presented in regard to those findings.
Does line 26 solve that problem?
No, because the operative language is limited to whether the sentencing court's findings of fact, and then you pick up, are supported by the evidence, constitute substantial and compelling reasons. Findings of fact may, in the